Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 11:48 a.m. and that is Pacific Standard Time. And today is Friday and it is February 10th, 2017. And of course, it being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. This has been a particularly eventful week. I feel like that there are a lot of topics to cover. So I thought I would kick off with this infographic that did the rounds perhaps a year ago, and it highlights just how dominant the top 10 consumer staple companies are, that they have a very strong presence in just about everybody's home all over the world, and they represent companies that have got very strong presences in terms of not only in terms of their footprint but also in terms of their brand loyalty. And I'm reminded of guerrilla warfare when I look at this one. It is how you unbundle, or at CB Insights, how they unbundled a supermarket, and they are concentrating on startups. So these startups, obviously there are quite a few more of them than the incumbents, and they are waging guerrilla warfare against those large companies. They're not going for their prime products. They're trying to eat away at their margins. They're attacking them where they see fat on their system, somewhere they can eke out a presence against what are very large companies. Some of them will succeed. Some will be bought out, and then within 10 years there will obviously be a whole new crop of different companies, and many of these will have disappeared. That also helps to highlight just how competitive an environment it is, and it has always been so. There has always been competition, but what we also saw today was that Reckitt Benckiser bought Mead Johnson. Both of those are autonomies, and it is a further example of how capitalism trends towards concentration. The winning companies, the larger companies, buy out the smaller ones that don't have the capital to fund their own growth. And that is how the capitalist system works. There is absolutely no evidence to question that that isn't going to continue to be the case. And I think that that is worth considering when we look at, for example, consumer staples. The consumer staples index remains in a reasonably consistent uptrend, defined by a series of ranges, one above another, and it has found support in the region of the 200-day moving average on successive occasions. And it's an impressive advance from 200 to 550 in the space of 8 years. However, there is an additional consideration, and it is this. In this graphic came out of one of Ian Little's presentations at the Markets Now, and it gives a nice graphic representation of cyclicality. And I thought that it would be worth paying attention to the right-hand side of this investment right now, because commodities, starting at the bottom right, commodities, shipping and aviation, technology, construction, banks, brokers and consumer finances, and property are all highly cyclical businesses. And something has changed for all of them in the last while. I'm going to refer to the KBW Regional Banks Index, and that is because it is representative of the USA's regional banks, and it experienced an explosive breakout in the aftermath of the Trump election. This is a very clear change. It had been ranging for a pretty prolonged period with a mild upward bias from about 2014, and now it is trading at new all-time highs, and it has held the majority of that advance in a pretty robust fashion. So this is still a really quite a clear bullish phenomenon. It is being pushed higher by the conviction that there are going to be some very clear pro-business changes to the US investing environment, but most importantly to the economic environment, that there is the real potential for deregulation of the banking sector, that there could be a reform of the Byzantine tax system, which could result in lower taxes, and that there could be a fiscal stimulus, which would be positive for the banking sector because they would gain increasing margins. And we are also getting higher interest rates, and the US banking sector has been laboring under a very tight margin environment because those interest rates have been so low, and they have now got the prospect of perhaps making more money on their basic business of making loans. Therefore, there is ample potential for the banking sector to continue to outperform. And then perhaps we should just look at that ratio because it is, I think, one of the things that is really worth considering. It is not so much about the absolute performance, but it is about the relative performance. And we can see now that the banks sector had been performing more or less in line with the consumer staples for much of the last 8 years, but now it has quite clearly broken out on a relative basis. So if we were to then start to think about what are the kinds of investments that will do better in the next medium-term outlook, then it is likely to be those cyclical sectors. But banks were at the top of that graphic. Then, well, what was at the bottom? Well, it was shipping. Shipping companies have been under incredible pressure, and we can see here that the Claymore Delta Global Shipping Fund has been performing more or less in line with consumer staples. It has not yet broken out. If we were to simply look at it in absolute terms, then it experienced really quite a profound decline, over 50% between 2014 and early 2016. It is still remaining within its base formation, but it is trading above the 200-day moving average and firmed from that region today. And I created this list of, and I'm just going to pull that over, of the price-to-book ratios for a significant number of shipping companies. It's actually the constituents of that ETF. And three quarters of them are trading on a price-to-book below one. Now, we don't yet have evidence of base formation completion. And there is, and this is still what could be considered a speculative area, because when a company is trading, for example, on a price to book of 0.29, it is doing that because it has very clear problems. So this is also a very good time to think about what if you do see a sector that has done spectacularly badly, and there is evidence that cyclical sectors are beginning to do better again, then what is the ideal investment? Do you buy relative strength, or do you invest in the thing that has done worst in the hope that it will play catch up? And considering that the sector has been the worst performer, it is usually better to buy the best performer within the sector, that there is something clearly better about that company because it has been doing better, and than everything else, that it is not the subject of whatever has been the debilitating factor that has driven the underperformance of the wider sector. There is a, and we have pretty good precedent for that. So, the big one, the one that has been doing best, is Maersk. And I'll pull up that chart. It has been rallying for much of the last few months, and bounced pretty emphatically from the region of the 200-day moving average, actually above it this week. And that we really should look at it over the much longer term. That has held this very volatile trading environment for over a decade, and it is coming off the lower side of that range. And this is a highly cyclical business. It's a cyclical share within a cyclical business, but it is coming off the lower side of that cycle. And technology was also well represented in on that graphic, and the Nasdaq 100 has been leading the wider market higher. It is now breaking away from what has been a 2-year range. What we can say very clearly on that chart pattern is that it is an impressive breakout. And then we have to ask very simple questions. Is it still reasonably consistent? Do we have any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend ending characteristics? Now, we may be getting a little bit of acceleration when we look at that on the weekly chart, on the monthly chart. If we zoom in a little bit, there isn't any great deal of acceleration. It would be very hard to argue that this is an acceleration. But what we do anticipate after something has been going sideways for a prolonged period of time is that you do get an emphatic breakout, and that emphatic breakout will result in an overbought condition in the short term, not least because the previous trading environment had been so very inert. And that is what we are getting. We're getting the Nasdaq breaking out on the upside, and that remains a proxy for the technology sector. I was also looking at the Nasdaq biotech sector today, because it is now pushing back up towards the upper side of its range. It has been in a base formation for over a year already, and there is a progression of higher reaction lows within the range. Now, there is significant differentiation between performance within the sector, because, for example, Gilead Sciences, which had been among the best performers, is trending lower and trending lower in a consistent manner. So that is one of the largest shares in the index that is not contributing to its relative performance, whereas Amgen is pushing back up to the upper side of an over 2-year range. And there are a significant number of companies that look like that. And perhaps the bellwether for the entire sector has been Biogen. It led on the downside. It is most representative of where the risk is in the sector, and it is still within its base formation, but it is not leading at present. The buzzword in biotech right now is immuno-oncology. And there are a small number of companies that are really focusing on that one particular sector. But we are in a point period of time where commercialization is rapidly coming to light. And because technology is a cyclical sector, and this is a time when cyclicals are doing better. It takes us back to the very big question about where are we in the overall cycle? Because we can look at the very, very long term. And what do we see? We see these very powerful, we see very powerful advances followed by very lengthy ranges. And that is something that we get time and time again. That the when we look at the log scale chart, we get a range in the 1930s and 40s, and a very big breakout, and a range between 1965 and 1981, and then a very big breakout. And it is incorrect to call it a breakout. It's a very big bull market. It's a secular bull market. And then we get this prolonged range that lasted until 2013. And then we get this new bull market. There is increasing, and it has been our argument at this service for the last 4 years that we are in a new secular bull market. There are an increasing number of people coming around to that idea. This is a new secular bull market that many investors have been conditioned by these incredibly traumatic breakdowns and downtrends within the ranging phase. But the most important point is that the ranging phase is over. This secular bear market, a generational-long period of P/E ratio contraction and rising dividend yields, or at least improving dividend yields, is over. And now we are in a period of a secular bull market where earnings growth at least attempts to keep a lid on on P ratio expansion. And what is driving this new bull market? Then it is the technological innovation, that we are in a period of time which is profound, and it is something that is changing the way that we even measure economic activity. That there is this speed with which technological innovation is occurring that is very hard for people to think about in linear terms, because the growth is exponential. That the pace with which technology is coming through is outpacing people's linear ability to comprehend it. And a way of thinking about that, and I wrote about this yesterday, was the difference in attitude between, for example, BP and Exxon, who write these long-term reports that are generally looking out on the energy sector with about a 15-year time horizon. But Saudi Arabia, by making the decision to IPO Saudi Aramco, isn't just looking at the next 15 years. They're looking at the next 50 years. They're looking at a period in time where the global population will no longer be expanding, it'll be contracting, because the birth rate will have had the effect that is predictable. The global birth rate peaked in 2011. We are still getting population growth because people are living longer and more babies are surviving. Both of those factors are enormously encouraging. And we are now in a period of time where a number of countries have the ability to harness their demographic dividends, and most particularly that is India. This week, Apple announced that they're opening a manufacturing facility in India. And the Indian market went sideways from 2008 all the way through until 2014. It then broke out on Modi's really impressive election victory. And now we're seeing this index pushing back up to test its high. And this is perhaps more important. And I want to show the rupee falling against the US dollar, because this is what I think a lot of investors will be looking at. The rupee has been in a secular downtrend. There have been brief periods of time when it rallied, but those brief periods of time when the rupee rallied have coincided with very impressive bull markets on Indian stocks. And now the rupee is testing the progression of lower rally highs. Now, if the rupee can break that progression of lower rally highs, then we could be back in one of those periods when Indian stocks outperform. And it has been a ranging environment, and it has been a market that has been completely off the radar because the currency has been going down so swiftly. You need to have a reasonably strong currency to have the correct recipe for foreign investors to become interested in your country. If they can get yield, capital market, and currency market appreciation, then money will pile into a country. And that is potentially very bullish for India. If India can transform its massive young population into a population of factory workers, and that then would unleash massive upside potential for their markets. The demonetization represented a hiccup in India's economic development, but it was an anti-graft move, and most particularly it had geopolitical connotations. It's also over, and the effects of the demonetization will have worked through the market within the next month or two. Therefore, it is probably worth starting to look at India now, because it could already be outperforming later on this year. there is increasing potential that it will break on the upside. And this also brings us back to the important question of the Wall Street leash effect. Wall Street has been really not been the leader in terms of economic growth and stock market performance for a while already. But the dollar is firming up. And there were perhaps, I think, a significant number of people that doubted whether the dollar would be able to sustain a rally. And not least, what we have now seen is that it has had a first step above this base. If we consider that the volatile ranging environment all the way from 2005 through to 2014 was a 9-year base formation for the dollar, then it has had the first step above the base. And now it is finding support in the region of the psychological 100. Now, a sustained move below 100 would really be required to question potential for the dollar to go higher. If the rupee can go higher than the dollar, if the rupee rallies faster than the dollar in a bull market environment, then that would be enormously beneficial for India. It would also help to tame inflation. And then there is the real potential that India could be very positive indeed. So we don't yet have the catalyst of the breakout. We don't yet have the catalyst of the break in the rupee's downtrend. But there is the potential that it is coming. So it is certainly worth watching. The dollar index has bounced from the region of 100. It has yet to demonstrate that this is more than near-term support. That we could still see an additional pullback. But when we look at other currencies, because obviously the dollar index is very heavily weighted by the euro and the yen, but if we look at the Asia dollar index, then it trended lower from early 2010 all the way through until now, and it is still trending lower. And there is the potential that we get an unwinding of the oversold condition, and it has done a pretty good job of doing that already. And now the question is whether that low will hold, because it is still a reasonably consistent downtrend, and this is about where one would expect the dollar to find support. And the Chinese renminbi is a big weighting in that index, and it is also in a consistent downtrend against the dollar. That it is one step above another. It has found support in the region of the 200-day moving average on successive occasions. It is still now within a consolidation phase, but nothing has really happened to question that the dollar isn't going to continue to outperform from here. If the dollar is the dominant currency and Wall Street is continuing to outperform, then that is enormously beneficial, because it is the USA's outperformance is representative of its economic growth, and it is still by far the largest economic growth center. It is led higher by its technological advantage and by the unshackling of economic potential through the three expectations of the market right now with regard to the Trump administration, and also by lower energy prices. It's been raining in California for the last few months. The vast majority of the state is out of drought. I don't think any of the state is still in extreme drought. And if we could consider that I don't want to make a statement about the efficacy of the argument about climate change or not, but rather want to talk about the traction that the idea receives. The majority of the policy making decisions over the last 8 years have been focused in California, which has been going through a massive drought, and that was giving people a very clear indication that there was evidence of climate change. And then you have the very Then they have the evidence in their wallets about how much money they're additionally spending on oil. And that cemented the belief that there should be some regulatory overhaul of the economy to try and bring down to attack the effects of climate change. And the Obama administration probably represented the pinnacle of the traction that idea had. Whereas now the drought has broken and oil prices are lower, and now we have a new administration. And that would represent perhaps that the argument will get less traction. And that would represent the potential for supply to increase. And if supply increases, then prices come down. And if prices come down, that removes a significant headwind to economic growth. Oil prices have been largely range bound and remain within that range. And even if we do get prices breaking up out of this range, and that is certainly not beyond the bounds of possibility, it remains quite unlikely that we're going to see oil prices getting back up to $100 on a sustained basis. We have a long-term chart of oil, and it will only be updated through the end of January. But we can look at oil over the very long term. And if we look at it then on a logarithmic scale, we have evidence of major bull and bear market cycles where you get prolonged ranging phases that give way to impressive uptrends, and then prolonged ranging phases which give way to impressive uptrends. And the last impressive uptrend peaked in 2009, and these lengthy periods of ranging can last for decades. So it might be not only 2019, but 2029 before we see oil prices moving to new all-time highs. That doesn't mean that prices can't range, and range in a very volatile manner, and move in significant percentage moves from trough to peak. But they are unlikely to rally for sustained periods of time. That oil is capable of rallying for a decade or more, and it is unlikely that we're going to get a decade-long rally in oil prices for at least the next 10 years. And there is the additional point about the pace with which technological innovation is increasing. I think there was I saw an article today saying that the solar industry now employs twice as many people as coal. And the efficiency of solar cells continues to improve, and it is following a pretty close approximation of Moore's law. What is not following an approximation of Moore's law is the enhancements in batteries. The energy density of batteries is improving, or is doubling, excuse me, every 5 years. And that means that the range anxiety that people have about electric cars, where they only go about 250 to 300 miles before running out of charge, will evaporate within the next 5 years, because they will then be driving over 500 miles. And within the next decade, they will go 1,000 miles on a charge. That is simply an extrapolation of the pace with which enhancements are happening in battery technology. If you can drive 1,000 miles on a single charge, then you're already outpacing the ability of a combustion engine to compete, and that is a significant threat to oil. The fact that you're already getting industrial batteries being installed. Then that represents a major benefit for the utility sector. And because right now they have to maintain additional whole generating capacity because they need to be able to meet base load when demand increases. If they can simply have a battery, then they can level out their production profile. That means they need less generating capacity. Well, that alone is a massive benefit for the environment. It is a massive benefit in terms of the price of energy, the price of electricity. And that also is an enhancement to the potential for economic growth. So then we have, so technological innovation is not only massively enhancing to our well-being, but as a result, it's deflationary. And that's one of the reasons why there is an increasing trend towards fiscal stimulus. Because we've tried just about everything else. That we had synchronized global economic expansion, then we moved into monetary expansion, and monetary expansion has been incredible. But it has not delivered the economic growth that people want. So now they're going to try fiscal stimulus. And there is the potential that we are going to move into a period of global synchronized fiscal stimulus, because the US is almost certainly going to go that way. China is already there, and so is Japan. And Europe is the laggard. There are significant risks with regard to Europe. And they're all political. Because Europe could fix its banking problem. The numbers are not so large that Europe couldn't fix them. But it isn't about the numbers, it's about the will. It is about the acceptance and of the mistakes that were made and what the real solutions are. And there is a clear need for some form of transfer mechanism. In the absence of a transfer mechanism, well, they're going to have to take off the straitjacket of austerity. The fact that Marine Le Pen is campaigning, she would probably do better if she simply campaigned on fiscal stimulus than any other factor. The fact that you have such high unemployment, and most particularly among young people, and that living standards have not been improving, that the clear route to holding the EU together is fiscal stimulus. And they need to agree that that is the case. If that is indeed, and it may take a shock to do that. It may take a surprise election victory in France or the Netherlands or indeed in Germany. And perhaps most particularly in Germany, to force that development. The European banking sector looks nothing like the KBW banking, the regional banks index. It remains in a almost decade-long base formation, which has been incredibly volatile. And it was down pretty heavy this week. And it is now testing the region of the 200-day moving average. The French election is only 2 months away, and it does have the capacity to represent a bearish overall signal for the wider stock market. It could be the one thing that could represent a factor for mean reversion on Wall Street. And the success of the European project is going to have to incorporate some form of fiscal stimulus. If they don't go that way, then that is going to represent quite a significant threat. The euro has been rallying for most of this year, but it has pulled back pretty much every day this week. And now it is testing at very clearly testing that short-term progression of higher reaction lows. It will have to rally next week if that progression is to be sustained, and that is very, I think, is really a 50-50 bet. because with so many challenges facing the Eurozone, how on earth could anybody be bullish about the currency? It is too early. It is, I think, too early to draw that conclusion. And the pound. And I've clicked on the wrong thing. Pardon me. The pound is also range bound, but we can see that on the weekly chart that it is a consistent decline, that this range that has been in evidence since the beginning of October has allowed the really quite deep overextension relative to the trend mean to be unwound, and it really will need to break up out of this range to confirm a return to demand dominance. What the UK has and Europe doesn't have is a single government. There is going to be a messy negotiation process, and there are probably unrealistic and ambitions on both sides with regard to those negotiations, and that would suggest that there is ample potential for additional volatility in currency markets. But the lower that currencies go, the better that is for nominal prices in terms of the stock market. And the FTSE 100 is now breaking up from a 17-year range. And I don't think that that is really highlighted enough, that this is an environment where there is a real potential for stocks to do well because of all the factors that we've discussed already. And the outperformance of the DAX index relative to just about everything else in Europe really does highlight that it has been Germany rather than any other country which has benefited so very clearly from everywhere else in Europe taking its currency. It isn't just India or the UK that is breaking or is testing the upper side of a long-term range. The Taiwanese market has been ranging, and I have to put it on a 50-year chart to show the whole thing, but it has been ranging since 1989, and that it has only spent a very brief period of time above 10,000 in that nearly 20 years, and it is now pushing back up towards that level. The Wall Street leash effect and the potential that we are moving back into a period of sustained economic growth fueled by fiscal stimulus is something that is going to help drive some of these long-term ranges up and out and up into new high ground. So therefore, this is an environment where stocks really are benefiting, and that cyclical stocks, cyclical sectors should also be doing well. If we are going to have fiscal, I really should look at the total return index. If we're going to look at the evolution of fiscal stimulus, well, that is going to have a profound effect on the government bond markets. There is an increasing argument that the bull market is over. There is also an argument among the people who benefited most from the bull market in bonds that this is another buy the dip scenario. And I think we're going to have an answer to that question within the next couple of months. The total return index has experienced a pretty steep pullback. It's a bigger pullback than we saw in 2013, not least because rates are rising now, and a reversionary rally has been underway. There are two things that we could look for that would confirm that this is a completed top formation. The first would be that it encounters resistance below or in the region of the trend mean, and the second is that it will move to and sustain a move to new lows. That would confirm the downtrend. Resistance in the region of the trend mean and a new low would confirm a new downtrend, and that would represent the end of a 35-year bull market. There is a wall of money invested in bonds. The bond market dwarfs the equity market, and it isn't just by a little bit, it's by multiples. So there is ample potential for bond money to move into the equity markets and really stoke a prolonged bull market. If we have a big bull market in stocks and we do have economic growth, then that is positive for the economy. But it is also something that will promote higher interest rates. And since we have been through an environment where interest rates have been incredibly low, then there is the potential that government bond yields will have to rise, because the yield that investors will demand will simply be higher. And I have tended to look at, and I wrote a lot about the Dow gold ratio this week. The most important thing about it is that it has 100 years. It represents the clear outperformance of one asset class versus another over long periods of time, and gold's secular bull market ended in 2011. And that we can continue to draw that conclusion as long as the ratio is trading above 7. But that doesn't mean that gold prices will be going down. If equity prices can rally for a prolonged period of time, so can gold. And gold prices are at the lower side of that long-term range. We have seen some evidence of a bear market raid in precious metals this week. And that was particularly the case in platinum. If we're going to have fiscal stimulus and there is basically money being created out of nothing, then the allure of an asset class that cannot simply be loaned into existence, which would be the precious metals or property. And the one thing that the precious metals have an advantage of over property is that it's mobile. But platinum today spent a brief period of time below $1,000 and rallied right back up. Silver prices are breaking up out of their short-term range. So that has now clearly broken the progression of lower rally highs since last July. And the Gold Bugs Index was also in positive territory today. It is pulling away from the region of its 200-day moving average. It has quite clearly broken its downtrend. And this also represents a cyclical sector. Commodities are a cyclical sector. They're coming off of really quite depressed levels, and they can rally significantly from here. And particularly the gold miners are now offering leverage to the gold price for the first time in a decade. And the commodity sector generally, and I tend to look at the unweighted continuous commodity index, continues to represent a recovery candidate. If the continuous commodity index represents a recovery candidate, so do commodity prices, so do miners, and so do steel companies. ArcelorMittal had quite impressive earnings today and was up pretty impressively. And it is coming off of really very depressed levels. Copper prices are breaking up out of this first step above the base formation, and it is now a new recovery candidate. So again, I'm going to finish off the audio by highlighting it is the cyclical sectors that are really starting to outperform now. And that is also characteristic of the latter stages of a big medium-term bull market, which would suggest that we are entering the final stages of the beginning of a secular bull market. And I think that is the clear message. And I thank you for your attention, and I wish all the best to all of you.